1994, and I'm interviewing Howard Amos, trainer at Churchill Downs Racetrack, longtime friend, associate, colleague, and someone who really understands the industry of horse racing. It's very good to be here interviewing my friend on this day. Give me your name, full name.
Well, Howard Franklin Amos Jr.
When and where were you born?
September the 7th, 1939, Louisville, Kentucky.
And your full name is Howard Franklin Amos Jr., right? Do you have any brothers and sisters?
Oh, I have one sister, Glenda Jones, who lives here in this fair city of Louisville, and one brother, Robert Skip Moore, who lives in New York City. Oh, as he would say, Brooklyn.
Were any of your family members involved in racing?
Well, I was bred both sides racing. My mother's family was born, moved out here in 1885. They built a house on Rodman Street. And my grandmother was born out here around 6th and Central in 1890. Hmm. And my mother was born and raised and hardly ever left this neighborhood, just for short visits. And on my father's side, all his people were from Lexington, Kentucky, and Virginia, and they worked for the Greeleys up there. I have a lot of pictures with he and J.J. Greeley, who never, you see on a picture, he didn't take pictures with the help. Mr. Greeley, for some reason, maybe didn't want to. But we have a lot of times they work for a large stable. Like most of my relatives out of Lexington work for the Greeley stable. And through meeting my father here in Louisville, that's how I came about. And I remember going over to the racetrack at ages, like, please, 7, 8, 9. I can remember 8 years old over in trainer S. Brian Ott's barn. And the old people used to be so nice, old trainers over there, Bill Went, Miss Hubbard, and Frank, Ole Clellan, and all them old timers, Tats Perosia. Well, it was like going to our afternoon recreation. We'd go to Tats Barn and play around. In the morning time, we'd milk his goats, and he'd make you drink some of that milk. You'd be mad all day. But, you know, it was so much fun, he said the milk was good for you. Oh. Then in those days, each stable had to have a fire outside to boil the water, and for the use in the stables, you had to help them get the barrel staves, which they most used for their fires and for the next morning. Well, so it was always a hustle to be made.
You have a nickname?
Yes. Fitty, they call me. Given that name by one of the elder statesmen of this neighborhood, Babe MacMillan.
My brother.
We called him John Levi when we wanted to make him mad.
Yeah.
But his name was Babe, a well-known singer. He was our coach for the guys my age, like me and Chester Tubby Grigsby and Cornelius Houston and Bully Ralston, worked for Joe Pierce now, and Armed Fights and Lee Jackson.
Right.
We called him Jim. He goes as Lee now. I don't know where Lee came from. But it was a nucleus, about 8 or 10 of us. Well, Babe was our coach, and he taught us everything.
Can you tell
me? And he emphasized going to school, so we all went to school, because that was part of coach's thing. You had to go to school.
Can you tell me if you were ever married?
Yes, for 15 years or so, to Olivia Williams Amos in Chicago, 1964. No, it was 63. My son was born in 64. We had one son, Howard Leslie Amos, who's now attorney, a Scorpio like yourself, attorney out in L.A.
He was never involved in horse racing then, right?
Oh, no. I don't know if he might be a little scared of horses.
Well, what did your wife think about your occupation in horse racing?
Well, she never even concerned herself with it.
Okay.
Because I was, you know, doing my business, teaching school, and she was teaching school.
And so your parents, your father was very involved with horse racing. He worked on the track, right?
Oh,
most
definitely.
Of his life, right?
Most of it. He was an exercise, what you call exercise boy.
He was
and
from, And a groom. Right?
Lexington by way of Virginia. Where all the earlier black horsemen came out of Virginia, if you notice. See, they're trying to return racing there now. But those breeding farms and things were in Virginia. You know, you see the old pictures of the old brother getting down there taking care of the horse and carriage. Well, that's all that. Even when he went into the army, he was in the cavalry. We have right. pictures of him with the cavalry boots. So we have a tradition of horse.
Can you remember the first time you ever saw a thoroughbred?
Oh, man, I know I was about, my first remembrance, I remember over in this Brianite's barn, and I think his horse was Valadina's Orphan or something like that. I was about 8 years old.
Valadina.
But I traveled with him when I was 2 and 3, because we have discussions of things I did over in Evanston, Illinois, when I was traveling with them. I rode on the walls and got in trouble. So I've been around ever since day one.
So you started.
Because I'm a racetracker's son, in other words.
You started working with horses when you were really young.
Definitely. I went away.
At the preschool level, really, when you first saw them. But then you started working around them when you were like a preteen. Right?
My first full job, I was about 14. We worked for Bud Greeley, and then I had to run and catch the bus at 4th and Central to ride down to school and to Central High School. But in those days, we'd play hooky and get out on Central Avenue and try to flag cars down and park cars, make you $2 or $3. And Bud Greeley would come down the street, and I'd have to hide. So he caught me one time, said, "Well, you can't work for me in the morning, you don't go to school." So I'd run on and go to school.
So school was important to you, though, right? To your family, right? They wanted you to finish school.
It wasn't no important as that first race was. Let's be real. I went because I had to go. They had firm discipline.
Yeah.
So with support.
The family wanted you to go to school, but you were torn between school and the racetrack.
No, I wasn't really torn between nothing. It was definitely the racetrack, one hands down. I went because I had to go.
And I heard you
not
say
because
one time,
I wanted to go.
You graduated from high school after having gone to 10th grade.
3 years.
3 years.
54,
right?
55, 56.
And those years
and
that you left.
Ali was down there having a good time with me.
After the years that you left the high school, dropped out, you go right on the racetrack?
No, they would defend you in those days for being absent too many days. And
I
during
see.
The spring races, and fall races, I wouldn't show up. We'd go in the front door and ease out the back door. And once I got in 11th grade, involved in sports, it tended to make you stay around a little longer. Mm-hmm. But I had a good baseball career I wouldn't even pursue because it was in the spring and it was interfering with the spring races.
Yeah.
The races weren't interfering with it. It was in, when I went to college, we would get out on US 60 and hitchhike to Keeneland in the mornings and walk horses. But getting back to the early experience, 14 and 15, we left here and we'd ride to Chicago with Slick. He'd take a carload. You know Slick James
right.
Dahl. He would take a carload up and charge us $2, $3 a piece. You know, he was on the plus side, so he'd have some pork chop sandwiches and we'd sing and go on up the road. And we'd get up, always left here late at night and got to Chicago, Washington Park early in the morning. And my first year up there, I was 15 and Reginald Peaches Roberts, a sort of retired jocks agent in Miami now. We worked for Stanley Buck Hazard. Assistant trainer was a well-known trainer around Illinois now, F.E. Ball, Francis Ball. And they told us we were too young because we couldn't get licensed. You had to be 16. So I just quit and went to work for Bud Greeley. We had an old steakhouse named Hazzy Amper. And just put your age up. I knew then, don't say I'm 15 no more, say I'm 16. And I think that Peaches had to go back, but that was my first gainfully employed. And then I'd always come back home in August because it was required of you, to go to school.
So you graduated from school, right?
Oh yeah, it wasn't
Central.
No problem.
You graduated from Central, and from Central you went on to Kentucky State, right?
Yeah, I was on the football team, and I liked the way those girls hollered when you played.
Yeah.
So I played.
So you played a little football in college and graduated from college.
In 1962.
And then went into school teaching.
Yep.
And racing always
simultaneous,
racing,
yeah.
Always racing and concomitantly with school teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, but it's, what kind of jobs have you held through the years? You mentioned one time that you were in the sporting goods store.
Oh, I owned the sporting goods store from 1966 to 76. And I was director of Backside Entertainment for the HBPA in Chicago, Balmore. Dave Feldman was director. And set up the recreation at Alton Park with the Athletes for Better Education. They would take the best basketball players from the city at the Lake Forest College and train them on getting ready to go to college, you know. But we set up a recreation program on the backside at Alton with the football and basketball coaches from Chicago. But I was the liaison between this group and the coaches because I knew both sides of it, you know.
I see. So, but all during the same time you were doing these things, you were still holding down jobs at the track?
Oh, you see, that was summertime.
Oh, summertime.
Yeah, at Arlington. Arlington's always summertime.
Now, who have you worked for, you know, as a groom or as a hot walker?
Well, I only worked for one person as a groom. Far as a week was Henry Forrest, and Bill Thayer was the bookkeeper at the time, the vice president of Alton.
Yeah.
That was about 1950, must have been 55, 56, a long time ago. But I was always a professional hot walker. I enjoyed that end of it. You got to go around the shed and meddle with everybody.
I see.
You didn't stand in one spot. You'd be around and around.
So
what
kind of stables have you worked for there?
Top Choice. What I'd call Tops in those days, we had the Hooper Stable. Okay. At Crozier, Breed Game, Admiral Voyage, all those years they had those horses every summer. Ivan Parks, Chuck Parks, they produced some good trainers, Cotton Tinsley.
Right.
And Ross Fenster Maker, Al Henson, and Mike Griffin. All those were working there together
with
us.
Were you living in Chicago at the time?
Well, I was a youngster. I was living on the backside.
Living on the backside.
Yeah, and then we would come back home to Kentucky.
Yeah.
I didn't live in Chicago until 1962, after I finished college.
College, right. I see. Did you ever work for yourself? Besides the sporting goods store, did you ever own horses?
Yes. I had like 15 down at Turfway. We called it Latonia then in 72, 73. Brought the black jockey down. He was exercising horses for Clifford Scott. And he wanted to ride, and we all knew he could ride better than a lot of those jocks that were riding. Name was J.R. Brown, they call him. He's in Louisiana, Opelousas. He's Cajun like those other Cajuns you hear so much about.
Right.
The dude, I think, he was chocolate, that his name didn't go through. And there's a bunch of them down there, they learned to ride just like those other boys. Well, he and his brother, who was Martin L. Brown, he was a jock. I won a race with him in Chicago. But J.R., I think we won six races at the Latonia that winter.
You can remember what years those were?
72 and
72,
73.
72 and 73.
See, it would be the winter of 73, like January, March, 73. So I'm sure it was. It was in 73. January, February,
you
March.
You brought a stable of about 16 horses down.
I had horses, four for Mr. Elmer Clark, and about four or five for Market Row Stable out of Dowsman, Wisconsin, and maybe three or four of my own myself. And I remember one old horse I bought off a guy down in Latonia for $100 and run him right back in 3 days and he finished third.
Who was he?
A horse, Faultless Twist or something.
Yeah.
The guys had him, they wanted to bring him back to Louisville.
Who was the first horse that you ever won with? Can you remember that?
Won.
As a trainer.
I guess it would
happen. You eventually got into horse training, of course.
Oh,
right?
I got my trainer's license same time, 1972, because I had every other kind. I got owner trainer's license in 1972 at Hawthorne, although I was stable as sportsman. I'm trying to think of that's something you said the first win. I don't know. I'd been around winter so long that. You know, with other people's horses, it never fazed me that this one was my own.
Your own.
Yeah.
Wanted to train to win first.
You know, but the help is the important thing back at the racetrack, anyway. Those good grooms. You see that boy Catfish rubbing that horse there, Vixen?
Yeah. Yeah.
You never read what he did, no room or nothing in there, but he's the one of the top ones back there. He's probably keeping that horse together and not getting no credit for it, you know, keeping them legs together.
I got an interview.
But I'm just saying, there's a lot of
questions.
It's a lot of, you see that over and over. I had good guys helping me, Edgar Hamilton and Popeye Canada out of Lexington, both of them out of Lexington. And a young boy down in the West End here called Tight. No talking Tom. I don't even know their real names now. But they know their stuff.
A lot of guys on the backside of the track, yeah, got a lot of nicknames, right?
Everyone got, yeah, one. You're not a real racetracker.
Yeah.
Even if you have some, they don't call you to your face, but you got one.
Working around with people, what did you learn from them? What kind of stuff did you pick up in terms of training?
Well, you learn more by the help that I had taught me more than working for someone else did, because they always kept everything they were doing more to themselves. The help wasn't supposed to know nothing they were doing.
I see.
And not even why they was using certain things. If they put a particular medicine on a horse's leg, they didn't want you to know why they was doing it anyway. This wasn't your business. You got your place, you know? So way you learn is from having the different people who know the reason why.
Now that's a different
help.
Yeah, that's different from the way other people have described it.
Yeah, or because they're not just... If they look at the truth,
you learn it the true way then, from the people who do the work, right?
Because, hey, them people that's training, you think they're going to come in and say, hey, I'm going to work his horse 5/8 a mile a day, and I want him to go easy, either because we're going to bet on him next Thursday. They don't tell you nothing. Tell you, go catch all the birds you can.
That's right.
And so that's what you get at that, all the birds we can get.
That's a different twist from the other people that I've been in, because they really don't look at it from that vantage point.
They know those. How much you think Ben Jones taught Alma Clark? Alma's a good friend of mine, I tell him. You know what he taught him? There's a door of those stalls.
Right.
And he'd pick it up from old rooms and sitting to see what old black folks always done is sit close to white people and listen.
Because
they weren't allowed to talk, and they heard a whole lot of things was going on. And we'd get back in the tack rooms at night and say, man, you know he worked that horse today? Say, he did. Said, yeah. So he was kicking the walls down. Said, I got in, rolled him in the stall that day and whooped his ass all the way around that stall. They don't know all this going on because they don't know what the grooms and things. It was a close-knit fraternity, right, in those days. And they'd take them out and maybe jog them around the shed before we take them to grandstand, because we knew this is what this horse needed. Old trainer didn't know. How would he know? And you'd be surprised.
Who were some of those oldsters that you worked around that gave you some of these ideas?
Oh, I think of the years I worked around, like Scotland Yard, Mr. Winston. Yeah. His knowledge of people was so great. He gave all the trainers a nickname. Like Mr. Pierce was the big barracuda, and his son was the baby barracuda. And we'd be taught that a big barracuda. And they got so they liked those names themselves.
Scotland Yard.
Yeah, he named them.
Fred Winston.
Yeah, and he had old sayings that were so true about, different little things he taught us. And it was really true. Like the best one you never forget, he said, I always remember, temptation never takes a vacation. And we'd sit up all night listening. He was married away from his wife. So the youngsters, we'd sit at his feet and all around the room listening to him tell tales about the coal mines and Nick the Greek and Pick Hal Slim.
Yeah.
But also, somewhere during that night, what Sam made up was sitting around the racetrack conversation, would get to a horse. We had one guy named Woods who'd ride on and on. At time he did at 8 and 4, 3/4 mile, 8 and 4, Washington Park, he ride the whole race, know every move that Steve Brooks did, can tell you every time he hit him what he was saying to the horse.
Yeah.
I mean, it was geniuses.
Kind of story,
it was geniuses.
Yeah.
He said, tell him he had 10 steps, what he said to him those last 10 steps. And when he got through, everybody in the room was riding with him. That's how good they were.
You learn from the help, from the people who work with the horses, right?
They exercise boy, they jump down, Pootsie. Edward Simpson, we call him Pootsie all his life. He jumped down off a horse and trainer wasn't looking. He looked both ways and said, this horse, he'll win next time he runs. You think the trainer going to come down and tell all the help, but they get too much money, they fear they'd leave.
That's right.
But he'd tell you, either they get out and say, man, look at it. I don't know what you're doing, but this, hey, man, this horse is soaring them out.
Yeah.
He said, I told the boss, but they don't listen to me. He said, well, I never bet nothing on him. And we watch them. They go out there and run them in big races, stakes, and handicap. And the help know that the horse ain't even conditioned enough to go around the barn. But some of the trainers didn't allow you to talk to them. It wasn't none of your business. Mm-hmm. And don't you dare speak to one of those owners when they come around. So they lost this...
the connection,
yeah,
the communication between the people who did...
What's the word you use when you... Rapport. They lost this rapport with the help because they run it... Like I said, sit down, not mean sit down. You have some trainers don't even hardly talk, didn't even talk to the groom.
Some of the system other trainers besides did. Besides Freddie Winston and Scotland Yard that you worked for, that you remember.
Well,
Tommy Long?
Oh, yeah, but see, Tommy Long, I was around him mostly as an adult, and he was very knowledgeable. But, I mean, as far as we went back to the boys, he's like Sam Martin, we called him Red Sam, and Calvin, out of Calvin Taylor, we called him Sarge out of Lexington, and Pulley, he galloped any kind of horse, weighed about 160, and Jimmy Ellis' brother-in-law, the red guy, what we used to call him, light-skinned guy, him and Pulley galloped those horses, he died here in Louisville, and with another guy that they died in an apartment down there. They asphyxiated.
Mm-hmm.
You know his name.
Q-Ball.
He's married to Jimmy Ellis' sister.
Right.
You know that, the boxer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was really, just everybody. A jockey like James Blackburn. He went on to New York to a great honor. But see, I was around all of them. I worked in Blanche's kitchen, which was really Mumford's kitchen. The Church of Downs where the toilet and outhouse is on the turn. That was a kitchen called Scotland Yard's mother-in-law.
Right, Irene.
Irene's kitchen, and the one behind it, where that compactor is back in there, that was called Mumford's kitchen. They used to put those big bowls out where you'd serve yourself.
So you saw a lot of blacks on the racetrack.
It was 90% black grooms in those days. Because the job had just left slavery when they wasn't paying much.
Yeah.
And then once the pay increased, the opportunities increased for the guys to bring their brothers and sisters off of farms and things.
What about the horses? What was the best horse you ever worked with? Who owned them and
would
what
believe,
made him a good horse?
I had one nominated to Derby the same year as Secretariat in 1973. A horse called French Knight. It only cost $100 in those days. I said, well, here's a chance to go down in immortality.
Did you nominate him?
Yes, sir.
He was on the nomination.
In those days, they put out them great big posters.
Right.
You don't hardly see that now.
Yeah.
With all the list of nominees. Well, the same year, Secretary, 1973, French Knight. I won with him at Turfway. What we call it, Sonia?
Yeah.
And then down here at the Miles Park, I went to Jamaica on vacation, and I called back my cousin-in-law, Jakey Bassler. They won with him down here at this little track here, Miles Park.
So he won three or four races for you.
Oh, right? Yeah, but he was cheap, $3,500. But
you,
it was just
you,
the...
Did you claim him?
Yeah, we claimed him off a guy out of Florida for about $3,000. See, in those days, Churchill ran
$3,500. Right.
They... The bottom is kind of high. You know, it's been increased over here. I don't know if it's high or not, but everything's gone up. So that's like anything. They can make the bottom $100,000 if they want to. That means that the cheapest horse you got is worth $100,000.
Was he the best horse you ever worked around?
No, I think my best one. It's hard to say. I had one called Diamond Mink. I won with Atlantic City in July 1987.
Was that the horse $300 you won the big price?
For $2, you got $334. I won four races with him. But each time he had to be shod correctly, he would hit in different spots and he wouldn't get all his full run out. And I knew that, so whenever I'd see where he'd hit, I finally got him in a position where he'd had a good blacksmith And they, he could really roll. He run 10-4 one time at Hazel Park.
Wow.
A DRC. Which one was that? DRC.
What kind of tracks did you work at over the years? You've been to a lot of Midwestern tracks?
Everywhere.
What are some of them?
Midwestern, you'd have. I'm licensed as a trainer. Michigan, Pennsylvania, owner, trainer. Michigan, owner, trainer. New Jersey, owner. Because I wouldn't need to meet buying work. Was comp, I was up there with the other guy, and we had all of them together, just one trainer down. Kentucky, owner, trainer. Illinois, owner, trainer. And I've also traveled to the racetrack, Trinidad, Jamaica. Where's this other place? Puerto Rico, as the El Comandante.
You mentioned workman's comp. What do you mean by that?
Well, if somebody's working with you.
You own a horse, you don't have to pay workman's comp? Is that what you
mean? No. If X amount of, in other words, if you hire somebody, you're supposed to be able to compensate them if they have a problem and they can't work.
I understand.
And the insurance runs nowadays about $1,000, $1,200 just for one employee alone.
I see.
And plus a lot of continuous paperwork, it can get real. So a lot of people to consolidate the stables and have just one trainer and just everybody put up on the workman's comp or whatever is necessary.
I see.
But it's very important to have.
If you, do you work on horse farms ever?
No, I'm not the farm type.
Okay. you're a city boy.
There's always been bricks out here in South Louisville.
That's right. If you had to pick one thing that you were particularly proud of in horse racing and in your career, what would it be?
That's night, that 99-1 lit up at Boyd in Atlantic City, of all the places, and all the help was hollering, all the guys was hollering the street.
Mr.
Clark took a van load up there, and we all put up on the gas, and the van stopped a couple times pulling those Pennsylvania mountains.
How many horses?
But we made it up there. We took six on this last
trip. Six horses.
And
from Chicago to Atlantic City.
Across Pennsylvania, Ohio turnpikes, you know. So it was a nice trip. But the thing is, what was great about that is just that I was taking care of myself because I worked for some fine Italian gentlemen up there, Mr. Peppino, who owns motels and things adjacent to Garden State. He invited me to come up there and move up that way anytime, he said. But I'd work for him in the morning, then take my horse to the training track. They closed at 11. We'd finish up about 9:30 every day. And it was really nice. You graze your horse out in the grass. And the horse loved it, and I did too. And when, you know, he ran a beautiful race. And it would have to be something to see.
99-1, huh?
Yeah.
That's the longest price horse in the history of Atlantic City, right?
Race course. That's what they said that night.
Wow. That must have been a thrill, then, right? Mm-hmm. Was the horse in front all the way, or did he come
from behind? Well, if you see the picture of him, he grabbed the leader at about the 16th pole, just the two of them, about 8 lengths out in front of the rest, and he went on about his business. He was going on about his business.
Talk a little bit about blacks. On the racetrack, tell a little bit about people that you know who've been in the jockey, groom, training business, and who some of the good ones were, and what was the condition of the race of blacks on the racetrack then, as to compare to now. And then, you know, let's talk a little bit about that.
Now, when you say, let's see, about being in that big city, I know so many of them. It's, as far as jockeys, man, it's been, I don't know where to start naming them. Like Martin Brown and J.R. Brown, James Long and Ronnie Jefferson, man, Leon Berry. I don't know. I might know. So many came through Chicago.
I see.
See, more than you'd see down in Kentucky because the opportunity there. Chicago usually had 10 to 12 black trainers every year.
Who was the best black jockey ever once you ever saw ride?
The best black jockey that I ever saw ride. Now, Cordero don't go as black, does he?
No.
But he, well, they don't.
I'm talking about the ones who consider themselves black.
Okay, I'd have to. Probably James Long. He's probably the best one. As far as proven record.
Right.
Because he rode $75,000 races on Desert Vixen.
Won.
In New York.
Yeah.
Not at the Cow Palace, you know, not out in the pasture. So you'd almost have to. I don't believe there's a modern day black jockey, except this boy that I met, Barnett. He won $100,000. That man, young man.
Mm-hmm.
He won $100,000 Budweiser race down in West Virginia
recently. How would you compare Long with Blackburn?
It would be hard to compare, because Blackburn, I didn't know. I just saw him ride, you know. But with James, he's riding for me and other trainers, and I'm more contemporary.
You know more about
Although I'd be a contemporary James Blackburn, he was older.
But you saw him ride, though.
Right? Definitely. Yeah. We used to stand right there in the gates and watch the jockeys go by. He was my first remembrance of black jockey was James Blackburn. Another gentleman named Fox. Ford.
Yeah.
And I hardly remember Fox.
Okay.
And in Chicago, a guy, I was in the room. We had a crap game at Arlington Park. Another guy took a pitchfork and hit him across his chest. Big Green, Jose Richardson.
Yeah.
And he went to the hospital out in Arlington Heights. He got on a van leaving town that night. And they had to drop him off at the hospital in Arlington Heights. And he died from internal injuries, I guess.
Jose Richardson, he was well known, wasn't he?
Yeah, because he rode on that I think he was out of North Carolina.
I see.
But he might have rode on the New York circuit. Then I met what's this boy up in New Jersey? McCurdy? Mm-hmm. He has a service station, a Standard Oil station up in New Jersey.
What about black trainers?
I was getting ready to say, black trainers, I'd have to give it, boy, it's hard, but I'd have to go for the man I seen win the big one, be Oscar Dishman, because the proof is always in the pudding. Now, a lot of you guys have won a lot of races, as far as numbers go, but to win $100,000 races in Chicago, man, you got so many things you fighting there. And he won it with Larry Snyder. And I think he won more than one. So as far as trainer that I'd want to emulate, that would have to be like Clifford Scott. Because he'd take claiming horses and win five or six races with them, and everybody made money. Because they, you know, it was good spots, and they'd bet and they'd win. And everybody in Chicago know Clifford Scott. Every black person that's all there to go on the track. To bet if Scotty run a horse, they'd come out on buses. Because they knew one thing, that Scotty gonna get the money. He and his wife would be at the track every day. And he would, be there. He was a friend of Cap Calloway, who died. Scotty died a year. And Mr. Seagrave, he was a top trainer. Won the Junior Miles Derby here in Louisville. And I remember betting on one of his horses here at Church Inn. That when they turned for home, I think she opened up four or five on them. I remember Big Rudy, I think, was working for him then, he told me. And then I remember Mr. Elsie Brown.
Who lived out
and,
here.
Lived right over, Miss Maureen Brown's husband.
Right.
Well, those guys were, and then you got Joe Willis and Uncle Mitchell.
Right.
I'm like, hey, man, we've had a minute. Then you had guys who, you know, really done miraculous work with cheap horses. Because I know sometimes it scares me to see, be able to take nothing and turn it into something. But if you get to know the horse, then you know what kind of belief to have in it. And it's really a very beautiful game.
What kind of schedule does one have to keep? Now, I know you're training a horse right now.
Mm-hmm.
You've been training him all summer.
What kind of
schedule do you keep in training a horse? I mean, you're doing this by yourself, mainly.
I have a helper who does the stall and takes care of the horse, Sam Dixon. He works another stable, and I'd saddle him up and get him out and watch his gallop about 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And time you cool him down and out and everything, you get out of there around 7:15 and go sub in a school somewhere in that area.
Right.
And make a day's work, because with just a small stable that I have now, what else would you do all day? Sit around and get bored.
Go back in the afternoon?
Every afternoon. Go back around 3 o'clock. School's out at 2:30. You go back about 3 o'clock, and if the weather's good, let them pick grass and graze and see that he's getting the right afternoon feed.
Cool and the racetrack. Right?
I couldn't think, couldn't think of a better place. You're doing the same thing on both of them. It's like coaching, trying to teach and see that something shows improvement from when you first started dealing with it. That's like with a kid, you want to see the
joy there.
Oh, definitely. It's seeing the improvement.
So you compare teaching school with teaching racehorses, teaching children with teaching racehorses.
There's a definite, there's a definite, you can see the similarities. The young kids are the same way. They learn, and some of them have bad habits when they come to you, and you try to help them change these habits.
And you do the same with a racehorse?
Definitely. Yeah. And you take some time, it takes longer to find out. Sometimes with kids, you don't never find out what it is.
You find out quicker with kids than you do with horses?
I doubt it. The horse matures much, quicker. I think it's something like 6 to 1 in age.
Yeah.
So whereas a horse is 6, he's a mature person. He's not too much you're going to find out about him. It's like a guy 30-something years old. You know him by then.
How you compare blacks, the conditions and the employment of blacks on the backside, say, now with 25 to 30 years ago?
I see it. It's the same. It runs along the same line as the outer world, the other part of the world, the outside the racetrack. It's the same thing. You might see a few blacks in certain jobs, but overall, the percentage of blacks, you find less workers than there were 20 years ago. Because, like I said earlier, it started from when the grooms were slaves and the trainers were all just past slavery and the jockeys, and very little money was to be made. So as the money got high, the need for some of that big money went to other people. They saw that, saw a way to make this money.
So a gradual decline of blacks on the backside.
Oh, sure, that people brought their families in.
Right.
My cousin needs a job, my nephew needs a job, my uncle.
And now on the backside, you see a lot of illegal immigrants, foreigners, and girls, right?
They doing more work for less money than some of the grooms were getting paid 25 years ago. You say,
is that just a church down? I saw it over there.
That's just the nature of that business. That's all it pays. So,
how do grooms and exercise boys and all those kind of folk get paid?
Well, the trainers pay them off, or the owner of the stable pays.
Do they pay a certain amount? Is there a rate?
Oh, yeah, as usual, what they call fair market price.
And how do you know the fair market price?
By asking the grooms know what they'll work for.
I see.
Say, if I got four horses I want you to take care of, and if you give them a fee, they know whether that's okay or not. They know, they know if it's out of proportion in any kind of way. And you know if you're paying them too much,
How do you see the future of blacks and horse racing? I know you were very knowledgeable about horse racing in general.
But
talk about that.
The percentage of what this, according to what area that they want to go in. The blacks don't want to come in as grooms and hot walkers no more. See, they're not interested in that area. All the blacks coming in now want to be owners and trainers. If you notice, they don't want to be bothered with even seeing a horse. Most of them don't want to come near them, or they want to say, they want to come out and be a trainer owner. You don't hear none of them coming out and want to be groomed.
Yeah, how do you feel about that? You think that's a disadvantage there?
Oh, well, who knows? Now, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a good horse and he run fast, the rest will fall in place. You find a good blacksmith, a good groomer.
How do you see the advent of people like Hammer and Gordy and those people in the horse racing?
Well, they've
been good for blacks in horse racing.
I look at it this way now. It's got to the point where they're not even enough blacks to raise fan about doing nothing to buy them. I mean, we know blacks bet like in Chicago. You go in the club grandstand, it's about 85% black in attendance. In Hawthorne, Sportsman, but
right?
not Arlington, because it's 30 miles
too
out of the city.
Right.
So the push of a black person into somewhere, it has to come from whoever owning, who's spending the money. And I don't know any that's trying to spend any money in horse raising, because the first bad experience they have, they tend to want to get out. This guy you met, Aubrey Davis, he spent right. $250,000, and they treat him like he's dirt. The man told him to take business to Walgreens if he didn't like the stalls that he gave him. You know, everybody can speak up about something you don't like. You know, say, well, I don't like these stalls. They're over here near this rubbish plant, and I want this horse. Well, take your business to Walgreens. And he bought all them horses off of their sales. The people Hawthorne sales. So they abuse them.
So what do you think, overall, what do you think about it? You think blacks have a future in horse racing?
Oh, yeah. Not just because they're black, though. Yeah. They have a future in it if they get some horses to run with.
I see.
That's all. That's what is required. It ain't you purple, green,
or what?
You don't
see discrimination then, much.
Yeah, there's discrimination in areas of it's like how many black certain type of coaches do you see? This is all money and entertainment, and people want to entertain themselves and friends. Then Mr. Wayne Lucas put on a nice show. If his horses don't win, he can put on a show for them.
Right.
That's about 80% of the game in a lot of cases. So who wants to see the show you putting on is the next thing.
So you look upon racing as like entertainment.
But I mean, it's entertaining business, definitely. That's what it is. If it's used for entertainment.
What are some of your goals in horse racing? Do you have something mapped out as to where you'd like to go with it?
Well, it's a mental map. I haven't etched it in stone. But I would like to get me anywhere from 3 to 6 horses, and be ready to race the Churchill route, then head for Florida in the winter, and back up to Kentucky.
Yeah.
Hey, at Florida in the winter time.
That good weather, huh?
What are you gonna do? The sun feels good.
And the horse is running good.
Even not. If you make enough at the meeting like Churchill Downs, you don't have to be as hungry in Florida.
See,
you win 3 or 4 of those races over there with pots like that.
Yeah.
You know, win with 2 of them, probably. And make you $50,000 to $60,000.
That's a goal.
That's
to have 5 or 6 horses and then travel the circuit from Churchill to Florida and back to Churchill and so forth.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
And have, England, Churchill, what about your dream? Do you have any dreams to having a real good horse like a Derby horse?
No, I don't even dream, man, because I know something. I hope to have it, though. It's one of what, but I meant there ain't nothing I would lay up at night and dream that was happening. It would be a nice thing. I'd like to have one.
Right. But it ain't no goal or anything.
Yeah, it would be a goal. It could be a subconscious goal, because I sure enough would like to.
Everybody wants to win the Derby, don't they? In the back of
but I feel, you still forget one other thing. Just think how many people had a thrill just running it.
I see.
Like the guy told me, he said, you know, it's one thing you did, you got to get all national news all over the country. He said that 2-mile race was better all over America.
Is that right?
Churchill simulcasted. That's what he's acting for.
I didn't know that.
Chili and Carl bet, so Carl said, hey, y'all shoot that motherfucker. Said, because I asked Chili, did you fit his horse, get in? He said, well, he might be out here on Robin, because I'm... said he was down there by the finish line, they ain't seen him yet.
What is the one thing that we off the tape in a minute? What would you like to say as a last word in this interview regarding horse racing, your interest in it, your goals and your future, or anything else you'd like to say in ending?
But in all truth, I'd like to say that the horse racing business has been wonderful to me and my family. Years of employment. I was able to get a college degree, my brother, my son, a law degree, and my sister and family. We always knew when the races come, we would eat. Right. And I have a small parking lot, and the people that you meet on the backside, I learned how to speak Spanish before I even tried to learn it, you know, tried in school. Right. From the Cubans used to come here and race every year. Right. And I'm telling you, it's been, and you meet some wonderful people. Now, the bad people they're talking about on the racetrack, I met more bad ones out here on the streets than I've ever met in the track. Right. Now, there are crooks and scoundrels, they're in churches and everywhere.
That's right.
But the good ones outnumber the bad. And this is one of the greatest businesses a man could ever get into. And the future in it, it's going to be up to the entrepreneurs and where they locate their tracks, and people using you know, locating them in the right spot, they're not gonna be able to stop them.
So what do you think then, racing is gonna be around for a long time?
It'll be around long before me and you are gone. It'll be around long, we'll be long gone.
What do you think about the impact of other kind of gambling will be on horse racing?
Well, they just probably run the horses through the casinos, or either run the casinos in the tracks. So you watch what I'm telling you.
Probably be the casinos in the track, though.
Well, they join it up all around. It's right. One thing that you found out that the best guns did out west. All the good guns got together, so they need us shooting at each other.
Right.
They'll get together.
Yeah, that's where you see it going. Now, oh, definitely. The depth of horse racing.
Oh, that's why they want? Who want to kill the Kentucky Derby? Not even devil wouldn't want to do that.
Some preachers would like to, though.
Well, he just talking because his hand wasn't in the fat part of the pot. You well, put his hand in the fat part of the pot, he'd have popped his fingers like everybody else, because it's the greatest 1 minute and 59 or 2 minute thrill that you could ever see with athletes riding horses, which has been one of the man's greatest entertainment. The animals, as long as they're not beastly hurt, and the jockeys wear protective equipment, it's a whole lot of fun.
And I'm glad to hear you say all those things. This has been an excellent interview from my friend Howard Amos. And one final word.
Is that there's so much you'd hate to forget. Like, I remember when the jockeys started wearing the goggles, and we used to get up on the brick wall to watch this jockey work, and a jockey called Goggle-Eyed McCoy. When he invented the goggles, then old jockeys like Georgia South and Johnny Adams. I mean, his racing has been so big and so good. How can you forget Peaches down in Florida? He's a master of bloodlines and breedings and knows all you need to know at the racetrack. He's a walking racing farm and computer. But it's just so many of them. His brother's been a groom with Whittenham Stables 25 years. But right. You think I'd attribute some way to Mr. Whittenham's success.
Oh, yeah.
You know, definitely. So I don't see, all I see is it's getting better. It might not be as big, but it's going to get better. And places that weren't racing will probably start racing just to add to the range of entertainment that man likes. It's a good, it'll work well with casinos.
Thank you very much, Dan.